Good evening. I'd like to welcome all of you to the New York Society Library. My name is Jeanette Sanger, and I'm proud to be a trustee of this wonderful library, founded in 1754. And in our front row, we have our library chair, who's reminded me that I should let you all know about our annual fund. And as you know, the library has so much to offer. In addition to our rich history, the wonderful events, the readings. We also have started serving tea in the afternoon, so you can come in and have a nice cup of tea and a cookie and read Proust. And and this is the really exciting thing. We have happy hour once a month where we serve liquor, and it's free. So that means you should be contributing lots of money. And tonight we are welcoming two fabulous writers, and we are so lucky, each of whom have written so eloquently about life, love, grief, and also about our deep attachment to our dogs. In thinking about this introduction, I wondered if I could find any doggy reference in the library's distinguished history. So I consulted Jenny Lawrence and Henry Cooper's book on the library and came upon this gem, entitled Dog Food, a letter by Cornelia Otis Skinner, written to the New York Society Library in 1931. Gentlemen, I am returning the four books drawn August 14th. I am extremely sorry to inform you that the Jusserand French ambassador was damaged while in my keeping. A young dog of mine, unbeknownst to anybody, chewed the cover. And I fear the binding is ruined. Yours very truly. Speaking first will be Amy Hempel, and her new collection, Sing to It, contains one of the most harrowing and touching stories I have ever read, a fictionalized version of her experience working at a shelter where dogs are euthanized. Amy has a deep commitment to dog rescue, particularly working with pit bulls. And she adores Gandhi, her own pit bull. In 1985, Amy's editor, the legendary Gordon Lish, suggested her for a reading at Books and Company. And Amy became a great favorite and introduced us to other wonderful authors, including Christopher Coe, who became a friend. And later, with great sadness, we held his memorial service at Books and Company. Amy is the author of Sing to It, The Dog of the Marriage, Tumble Home, At the Gates of the Animal Kingdom, Reasons to Live, and the co-editor of Unleashed. Her stories have appeared in Harper's, Vanity Fair, GQ, Tin House, The Harvard Review, The Quarterly, and have been widely anthologized, including Best American Short Stories and the Best Non-Required Reading. She teaches in the graduate writing program at Bennington College. And I know when she goes to Bennington, she also teaches with Susan Cheever, and they live in the doghouse there. And at Stony Brook, Southampton, she lives near New York City. She has received numerous honors and awards, including a Guggenheim Fellowship, the Ambassador Book Award in 2007 for her collected stories, and named by the New York Times one of the best books of the year. Recently, I learned something about Amy that many of you probably don't know. She does have a tattoo. I shall not tell you where or what it says. After Amy, Sigrid Nunez will speak. And I have admired Sigrid Nunez enormously since I read her first novel, A Feather on the Breath of God. Just the title, I think, is so beautiful, which came out in 1995. I thought then, and I still feel, it has one of the most beautiful covers I have ever seen. I clambered up my ladder to retrieve it from my bookshelf, and I'm happily rereading it. Sigrid has published seven novels, including A Feather on the Breath of God, The Last of Her Kind, Salvation City, and most recently, The Friend. She is also the author of Sempre Susan, a memoir of Susan Sontag. Among the journals to which she has contributed are the New York Times, the New York Times Book Review, The Wall Street Journal, The Paris Review, Three Penny Review, Harper's McSweeney, Tin House. Her work has also appeared in several anthologies, including four Pushcart Prize volumes. And one of her short stories has been selected for the Best American Short Stories 2019. Nuna's work has been translated into 9 languages and is in the process of being translated into 14 more. She received a Whiting Writers Award and is the recipient of 2 awards from the Academy of Arts and Letters. Her most recent book, The Friend, won the National Book Award. Sigrid Nunes' many fans will be happy to hear she has just finished her 8th novel, which will be published by Riverhead. After Amy and Sigrid speak, we will have a Q&A, so start thinking about questions. And now let us welcome Amy Hempel.
Thank you, Jeanette. Thank you so much. And thank you for thinking to pair us tonight to read and talk. I'm just an immense fan of Sigrid's work and of Sigrid herself, which is not always a given. It's not always that way. But it's a great treat to be here together. How's the sound? I can hear it. So I'm going to read, I don't know, 3 or 4 short shorts, and then I'll say a few words about why 10 of the 15 stories in my new book are short shorts, okay? I'm a fan of the defining moment. In many situations in our lives, you can identify as it happens, the moment that's going to just reverberate for years to come. And most of these stories have a moment like that. This is called The Orphan Lamb, kind of a dark little, very little dark love story. He carved the coat off the dead winter lamb, wiped her blood on his pants to keep a grip, circling first the hooves and cutting straight up each leg, then punching the skin loose from muscle and bone. He tied the skin with twine over the body of the orphan lamb so the grieving ewe would know the scent and let the orphan lamb nurse, or so he said. This was seduction. This was the story he told. Of all the farm boy stories he might have told, he chose the one where brutality saves a life. He wanted me to feel, when he fitted his body over mine, that this was how I would go on. This was how I would be known. There aren't as many dogs in this book as there usually are in my books, but here's one. Here's one that does have it. Moonbow. People are getting away with murder, but I can't get away with having a glass of water in bed. I trade sides with my dog who won't feel what I spilled anyway. From this side of the bed, I see the moon through the window. It's a full moon with something extra. I've heard about this, but not in upstate New York. In Africa, where the mist from Victoria Falls on the night of a full moon can cause a rainbow to form, a white one, a moonbow. People book vacations to see it. I head downstairs and out to the small backyard. Who else is seeing this? And then I see who else, a small brown bear, or maybe it's black. I freeze, trying not to look scared, because that's when they attack, I'm told. A bear is moving calmly from the neighbor's yard into mine. He looks up at the moon. We look at it together. The bear drops to the ground and then stands up pawing a ball. It belonged to my dog, the other one who died the month before. The bear sees the dog's water bowl I've kept filled from habit or hope and helps himself to a drink. He wraps himself in the rope from the old tie-out. He swipes at the gone dog's favorite plush toy, a damp, matted lamb with a squeaker torn out. The bear rolls on his back under the freakish white rainbow, his feet like those of one other creature I knew. Logan, I ask, moving a step closer. It's all right. I tell him what has happened since I lost him and assure him that I approved of his valedictory bite, that deliveryman who had it coming. I tell him that the deli has gone up for sale, that another antiques store has opened, that I hate my haircut, that I have not thrown anything away, that the water in the kitchen has developed a metallic aftertaste. And then the bear is leaving on his feet and moving to the back of the yard. He stops by the old rope swing. I think he's going to put his legs through the tire and push off toward the moon. But then I see he's got the rope between his teeth. He chews and shakes his head until he's chewed through the rope and the tire falls to the ground, where the bear kicks it out of his way as he tears off through the woods. One thing I do in real life is I move a lot. Can anyone relate here in this audience? I move a lot. Hence, equivalent. The former owner was supposed to fix the door. Instead, he left behind a pool cleaning robot. He said it was equivalent to fixing the front door, though the house had no pool. It had once had a pool. But the seller's wife had been the swimmer, and when she died 4 years earlier, he filled in the pool. At the closing, the buyer's attorney pointed out that the repair of the door was contractually bound. She brought out the contract and showed him. He said, "You just had to put some shoulder to it." The buyer wanted the house, so she was the one both sides knew would give in. Every couple of months, the seller arrived unannounced to pick up something he had left behind, a wall phone in the den, canoe mounts in the shed. The buyer allowed him to take what he wanted, then asked for help with a difficult chore. She asked him to turn the mower on its side to drain the oil and double-check the basement's radon remediator. Each favor she asked extended the time until the seller's next visit. The weeds in the garden, the buyer bets that this will be enough to keep the seller from coming back to get the child's blackboard in an upstairs bedroom, the child's name formed by animals carved in the wooden frame. And last, the title story. There's more than one tattoo, Jeanette. It's more than one. I do have sing to it in Arabic tattooed, and you'll see why in Arabic in just a moment. Title story. At the end, he said, "No metaphors. Nothing is like anything else." Except he said to me before he said that, "Make your hands a hammock for me." So there was one. He said, "Not even the rain," he quoted the poet, "not even the rain has such small hands." So there was another. At the end, I wanted to comfort him, but what I said was, "Sing to it." The Arab proverb, "When danger approaches, sing to it." Except I said to him before I said that, "No metaphors, no one is like anyone else." And he said, "Please." So at the end, I made my hands a hammock for him, my arms the trees. So I did say I would say a few words about the appeal of the short form. I've loved reading them, writing them, teaching them, talking about them for many years. And I think a while back, years ago, I remember I Googled. I think I asked something like when were the first short shorts, or when did the first short shorts appear? And up came the name Bob Gaudio, because he's the guy who wrote Who likes short shorts? We like short shorts. He wrote that. He wrote that when he was 15. And later in his life, he made, if Google can be believed, and I believe everything I see on the internet, he made $2 billion as a producer of Jersey Boys. So oh. Bob's doing well. Grace Paley told somebody that the term short story sounded more like a form than a genre. More like a stutter than a form. More like a stutter, short. And I remember reading a beautiful collection by Yasunari Kawabata, who won the Nobel Prize in the 40s, whose book I think a lot of you probably know, Palm of the Hand Stories. His sense of a short story was that it should sit like a jewel in your hand. You would gaze at it like a jewel in your hand, in the palm of your hand, which is a lot more optimistic than the Russian writer, also of short, Daniel Karms, who's one of whose volumes of short is titled, "Today I Wrote Nothing." And it's a bit of a bleak volume at that. I seem to be quoting a lot of people, but there are some good comments, or many good comments, many people have written well about this form. David Mamet wrote a piece in the Times years ago, I'm sure some of you saw it, called Hearing the Notes That Aren't Played. And he said something I really appreciated, and that is, omission is also creation. Omission is also creation. And I think a lot of people feel that the short story is a regular story that you pared down. And maybe some other people write them that way. I don't, because they have a different purpose. It's not just about the length, you know. They have a different purpose. There are, shorts that are parables. And I think one of the best ones, if you're interested in going and looking things up when you get home tonight, you could look up The Three Hermits by Tolstoy. A beautiful short parable. They present a story that maybe starts in the middle and finishes before a normal ending, and they can be a kind of life's like that, or part of life is like that moment. But they're moments. They're moments, and my favorite kind of short story is really the one that is like a flashbulb moment, that it is a story of an experience or a moment in which somebody realizes something, and as like a flashbulb, like a light going off. And ideally, I mean, some of the best ones have two things going on simultaneously. And years ago, when I was teaching at Bennington, I was teaching a short class, and there was an older woman in the group. She was a psychologist. And I wish I could remember her name to credit her, but she wrote a less than two-page story that I'll never forget. And it went back to when she was a girl. And however old you are when you can first, go to a friend's house after school and do homework and maybe stay for dinner and then you go back home. And she wrote this very short story about all the times she would get on her bike after school and pedal over to her best friend's house and they'd do homework and then she'd come out and pick up her bike. She'd thrown it in the lawn because the kickstand was broken, and she'd get on her bike and she'd pedal back home, and how one day she came out after doing homework at her friend's house and her bike was standing up. And she said the exact same moment she was incredibly moved that her friend's father, you know this story, Barbara, that her friend's father had thought to repair the kickstand and ashamed that her own father had not. and it had stayed with her for 60 years. And then there's the wild kind of short, I think of, but there, oh, 15, oh, 1 minute? We have a timekeeper up here. I'll shut it down in just a second. I just want to describe one of my other favorite short shorts. It's called Even Greenland by Barry Hanna. And he has a, it's a brilliant story about two men, best friends, arguing over who gets the best last words as their small plane is going down. Okay. So there are a million ways to do the short form. They're incredibly satisfying to write and to read, and I hope you will look up some of the ones that I've mentioned, and maybe we'll talk a little bit more. And now I give you Sigrid.
I don't have any tattoos
yet.
I want to thank the New York Society Library for having us, and thank you for that introduction, Jeanette, and thank all of you for being here. I am extremely happy to be reading with Amy, which we've never managed to do before. But Amy started publishing before I did, a while before I did, yeah. And so I can say that Amy was an influence on my work. And I was just reading a, there's an article by, an essay by Zadie Smith in the most recent New York Review of Books about fiction. And there's a certain part where she talks about no matter what is going on in the fiction she might be reading, if the sentences aren't a certain way and they don't engage her, then nothing about that book will engage her. And as I recall, the way she described it was sentences that were written with balance, care, rigor, and integrity. And I read that and thought of Amy. And that is why when Rick Moody was writing the introduction to her collected stories, the first sentence of that introduction is, "It's about the sentences." And then he writes a very beautiful paragraph. I wanted to talk first and then read a couple of pages, but I was just going to talk a little bit about how my novel, The Friend, came to be. My most recent novel before it had been published in 2010, Salvation City, and then my most recent book, the memoir about Susan Sontag, was 2011. So a couple of years had gone by, and it was the time, I was not working on anything at that time, but the time had come for the Boston University annual faculty reading, and I was teaching there, I'm still teaching there, and I wanted to read something new. I mean, it didn't have to be something complete, but I thought I could read something and say, I'm reading something from the beginning of something I'm writing, even though that was not true. And but because several people were reading, they only wanted us to read for about 8 minutes. So I sat down and I wrote a couple of pages that really, you know, are pretty much exactly the way they appear in this book. And I did like the response I got to those from that reading, and then I knew that shortly after that, I'd been asked to read at the University of Maryland, and they wanted 25 minutes. So I carried on. And right from what I was reading, by that time, that, you know, 12, 13 pages, whatever that was, there was no dog yet. I had no idea, you know, really what was going to happen, but I had these pages that told me that I was launched on something that could be a novel. But then as for what was going on in my head at that time, I had for several years known that among the people that I knew, friends, acquaintances, there were several of them who had suicide in their thoughts, not people who were crying out for help, nobody who was in a particular crisis at that moment, but they had started thinking that that might be in their future. That might be how their story ended. And so that was very much on my mind and very significant to me. And also, one of those people has since then taken his own life. And also, as I'm sure everyone here knows, suicide among all groups has been very much on the rise for quite some time. And then I also, I've always loved animals and been kind of obsessed with the human-creature bond. And I did always want to write something in which an animal, particularly a dog, featured prominently. I had written a little book, which was a mock biography of Leonard and Virginia Woolf's pet marmoset called Pet Monkey. Marmoset, as you know, is a monkey, called Mitz, the Marmoset of Bloomsbury, which was inspired by Virginia Woolf's mock biography of Elizabeth Barrett Browning's pet cocker spaniel named Flush. So then also sometime before I started, I had wanted to write a novel about a sex trafficked young woman, and I gave that some thought. I made an attempt at that, and I just realized that I couldn't do it. To be immersed in that world for that number of years, it was too much. But I did have, it was on my mind like these other things, and it was something that was important to me and that I wanted to write about, and I saw a way that I could use that too. And so all of these strands came together. I saw a way to bring them all together into one book. So the friend, in the friend, a woman who has lost her lifelong best friend and mentor to suicide, is the one who ends up taking his the Great Dane, the 180-pound Great Dane that he left behind that nobody else is willing to take care of. His name is Apollo, and he was found abandoned in Prospect Park, so his history isn't known. And so he is in mourning because he doesn't know what happened to his master, and she is in mourning. So they're both stunned state of grief, and they're both living in her 500 square foot studio apartment, in which the lease stipulates that no dogs are allowed. All right, so I'm reading from part five, just a couple of pages. Did you read about the Tibetan mastiffs? I had indeed read the article in the Times, and I say so, but the woman's need to vent is too great. She tells the story anyway. Only a few years ago in China, the Tibetan mastiff was a status symbol, a luxury item priced at the equivalent of an average of $200,000, with some puppies said to sell for more than a million. As the mania peaked, more and more dogs were produced by grasping breeders. Then the mania died. Worth too little, eating too much, the huge and sometimes hard to control dogs were no longer wanted. What came next? Mass abandonment, dogs packed into transport trucks where they suffered horribly and many died, the slaughterhouse. Truly not a story I needed to hear twice. The woman is someone Apollo and I often meet when she's out walking her own two dogs, gentle mutts, mother and daughter. From the news story, she goes into her screed. It too is something she's shared with me before about the evils of dog breeding. Mutts are what nature intended. Mutts are what should exist. But what have we got instead? Idiot collies, neurotic shepherds, murderous Rottweilers, deaf Dalmatians, and labs so calm you could shoot a gun at them and they wouldn't suspect danger. Fur, vegetables, cripples, morons, sociopaths, dogs with bones too thin or flesh too fat. That's what you get when you breed dogs for the traits people want them to have. It should be a crime. I thought this woman was crazy when she told me about pointers that freeze in point posture and then can't get out. But this grotesquerie turns out to be fact. I shudder to think what it'll be like 50 or 100 years from now, says the woman, looking very dark indeed. But by then, she adds, the whole earth will have been destroyed. and perhaps consoled by this thought, she takes her mutts and moves on. I am left thinking about the mastiffs. Besides their great bulk and a mane that makes them look part lion, they are known for being fiercely protective and loyal to their masters. So what does a dog bred for those traits feel when its master lets it be herded onto one of those transport trucks? Does a dog understand betrayal? I think probably not. I think the main thing on the mastiff's mind all the way to the slaughterhouse is, who will protect master now? A digression. About animal suffering, what do we really know? There is evidence that dogs and other animals have a higher tolerance for pain than humans do, but their true capacity for suffering, like the true measure of their intelligence, must remain a mystery. The writer J.R. Ackerley believed that being so emotionally involved with people and trying forever to please them made a dog's life chronically anxious and stressed. But did they get headaches, he wondered, not even that much about them being known. Another question, why do people often find animal suffering harder to accept than the suffering of other human beings? Take Robert Graves writing about the Somme. The number of dead horses and mules shocked me. Human corpses were all very well, but it seemed wrong for animals to be dragged into the war like this. Why, of all the terrible memories of his ordeal as a POW in Japan during World War II, was Olympic athlete and U.S. Army airman Louis Zamperini most haunted by the memory of a guard torturing a duck? Of course, in each of these cases, the suffering was caused by human behavior. In the case of the duck, an act of pure sadism. But aren't animals always at our mercy? And doesn't the pity we feel for them have to do with our understanding that the animal itself has no way of knowing the reason for its pain? A fact that makes some people insist that animals must suffer even worse than humans do. I believe the intensity of the pity you feel for an animal has to do with how it evokes pity for yourself. I believe we must all retain throughout our whole lives a powerful memory of those early moments of life, a time when we were as much animal as human, the overwhelming feelings of helplessness and vulnerability and mute fear, and the yearning for the protection that our instinct tells us is there if we could just cry loudly enough. Innocence is something we humans pass through and leave behind, unable to return. But animals live and die in that state. And seeing innocence violated in the form of cruelty to a mere duck can seem like the most barbaric act in the world. I know people who are outraged by this sentiment, calling it cynical, misanthropic, and perverse. But I believe the day when we are no longer capable of feeling it will be a terrible day for every living being, that our downward slide into violence and barbarity will be only that much quicker. There is a Hungarian film called White God, in which the dogs of Budapest rise up against the oppressor. Like all uprisings, this one has a leader. This is Hagen, the beloved mixed-breed pet of a girl named Lily. His ordeals begin when Lily's father refuses to pay the tax imposed on anyone in possession of a dog that isn't a purebred. Thrown out in the street, Hagen tries to find his way back to Lily, who meanwhile is doing all she can to find him, but is thwarted, first by dog catchers, then by a brute who, using the cruelest methods, trains Hagen to fight. It is after he's killed another dog, Hagen's first time in the ring, that he understands not only what he's done, but what has been done to him. He escapes his trainer, but is soon trapped by dog catchers and hauled off to the pound, where he is slated to be destroyed. But again, Hagen escapes, at the same time liberating a large number of other dogs who follow on his heels as he tears through the streets. The pack of running, in some cases attacking dogs, are joined by more dogs from every corner of the city. Hagen has raised a canine army. One by one, his enemies are sought out and viciously killed. By now, though, the once gentle Hagen has been so transformed that when he finally meets Lily again, in the courtyard of the slaughterhouse where her father works as a meat inspector, he bares his teeth and snarls. She is a human being, after all, and her father, who started this war, is there with her. Ranged about Hagen are the members of his army, everyone prepared to strike. The frightened Lily remembers how Hagen used to like when she played to him on her horn, her instrument in the school orchestra, and the soothing effect it had on him. She takes the horn from her backpack and begins to play. Hagen is calmed and lies down. Then all the other dogs grow quiet and lie down too. Lily plays on, prolonging the moment of peace. It is not a happy ending, because we know, of course, that the dogs are doomed, but they have had their revenge. It's easy to see why many people, including myself before a high school English teacher set me straight, believe that someone once said, "Music soothes the savage beast." Music has charms to soothe a savage breast, is what the playwright William Congreve actually wrote. But it's part of our mythology, a wild or angry animal calmed or tamed by music, which makes sense given all we know about how music can affect the spirits of a human being. In White God, right before a dog is put to death, it is placed in a room with a TV showing the old Tom and Jerry cartoon, The Cat Concerto, in which Tom plays Liszt's Hungarian Rhapsody No. 2. I don't know if playing music really can soothe a dog's breast, but on the internet, I find it among suggestions for dealing with canine depression. But what kind of music? I once had a rabbit that I let run loose in the house. In the living room was a stereo whose two large speakers sat on the floor. Whenever music was put on, the rabbit would make his way to a speaker and plant himself there. Usually he'd just lie still, listening, or maybe he'd start to groom his ears. But if I played Bach's Sheep May Safely Graze, he would get up and cavort around the room. So what kind of music? Cheerful, mellow, fast, or slow? The Hungarian Rhapsody No. 2? How about some Schubert? Oh, maybe not Schubert, whose pen, in the words of Arvo Pärt, was 50% ink, 50% tears. How about Miles Davis' Bitches Brew? I know this is all moronically anthropomorphic, but sometimes that is the form love takes. I play Apollo Miles Davis, I play him Bach and Arvo Pärt, I play him Prince, Adele, and Frank Sinatra, and Mozart, lots of Mozart. None of which appears to affect him at all. I don't think he's listening. If he is, I don't think he cares. Then I remember reading about an experiment in which a group of monkeys that were given a choice between listening to Mozart and listening to rock and roll chose Mozart. But when given a choice between Mozart and silence, chose silence. Thank you very much. Material for
writing? I just pulled it, yanked it off. Yeah.
Thank you.
My brother's in the audience. He has cats. I feel I better come up with something here. I had cats or a cat in my very first collection, but I have a better connection with dogs. I have a fuller, cleaner, more varied, amplified connection with dogs. That comes naturally. Nothing against cats; they're great. I hope to have one again. but it's the dogs that I know have known, even for just a few hours at the hideous kill shelter I worked in, that they're the ones that stay, you know, in my heart and that end up on the page. Yeah,
I'm a cat person, actually, and the narrator of my book is a cat person, but you were asking about them as material, and I don't think that a cat makes as good a literary character as a dog, particularly if you're writing about the dog in relation to people. Because it's about that the human canine bond is something that, you know, I think you can make, you know, rich fiction out of that you wouldn't be able to do as well with a cat. That's true. Here's a question.
Here's one.
Probably, because I mean, most of the most of what I've written has been, you know, set. I mean, New York. It's not like New York has been a really important part of the story, but it's where I have set most of my work. And I guess you really are formed by a place that you've spent your whole life in. But I don't think I don't know. It's something I actually haven't really thought of that much. Yeah.
The complexity and the subtlety of your work and its breadth.
I don't think that people who live in urban environments necessarily write more complex or subtle or nuanced work than people who don't. I mean, I don't think. So I'm not sure there's a connection, but I do feel like, you know, an urban writer. I do feel, you know, stimulated by urban life, inspired by it in what I write. Yeah. Question?
Susan has one. Oh,
sorry.
Hi, guys.
Hi, Susan.
Hi, Susan.
Oh, yes. The cat and his father.
And his father.
Yes.
Exactly. It's really about his father, but it purports to be about these cats. And I also wrote about the state of matter. I mean, there's a lot of wonderful work in which animals are used. And that's a big question. So can you talk a little bit about the use of animals in fiction and nonfiction?
Thanks for that, Susan. Susan's corgi, by the way, is writing a memoir. What is it? What did we call it? Wait, what's it called? Something? No, it's Just Whistle, the Eli Cheever story. That's it. That's right. Do you want to start?
I think, well, for me, there's definitely a connection with the fact that, you know, when I was a kid and I was, you know, really, you know, one of those animal crazy kids, and also loved reading and being read to before I could read myself. And of course, a lot of children's literature is about animals. A lot of it very painful, memorable in that way. And And there was always that, you know, to me, like, was there anything more moving than, you know, a story about a child bonding with an animal? It was horses and dogs, mostly, I guess. And so I always had this idea when I was growing up and thought I would be a writer that what I would write was children's books. And so I always, you know, and so that I think is partly why I always wanted to write about an animal. And also there's something about particularly dogs. I mean, that's a particular aspect of human experience that so many that you share with so many people. I mean, not everybody loves dogs, not everybody loves animals, but those who do, and there are many of them, relate to them in really similar ways. Mm-hmm. And I think that's part of it. So you feel when you're writing about an animal that you're touching other people, you know, somewhere where you want to touch them. And also, what is that, you know, animals make us human, as the Aboriginal saying. Yeah, and so, you know, so I think it's really very rich, and it's something that that people avoid, I think, because of a certain fear or taboo, because you think once you start writing about animals, you're going to be sentimental. And that's what's what people don't want to read and what you don't think you should be writing. But on the other hand, we both always want to include in our work, even if it's about grief or pain, an element of the comic, an element of the playful. And writing about animals certainly fits into that.
Oh, yeah, I agree completely. And I mean, I think I know so many dogs who just crack me up. They're just hilarious. They play jokes on you. And my dog that I have now, we never get tired of this one. I mean, he's always in the passenger seat. And if I stop and leave him in the car for literally 60 seconds and I race in and get a cup of coffee and come back out, he is always sitting upright in the driver's seat. And I always laugh, genuinely, it always cracks me up. He loves that he has that effect, and he'll do it till he dies. And we both enjoy it immensely. And that's, I mean, you all, all of you have an animal, you know, that this is familiar stuff. But I was interested, Susan, you mentioned, the absolutely brilliant personal essay by Joanne Beard, The Fourth State of Matter.
Yeah.
And some of you are nodding your heads, and of course you've read it. And I just gave it to my grad students literally yesterday, and I've read it countless times. And another writer can learn a great deal from reading it. That's on the side. Just as a piece of work, she breaks so many so-called rules of writing, like don't write towards the story, start with the story. Well, she doesn't start with the story, though she puts a line in here and there that's incredibly ominous. But she opens with the old collie, and she holds the collie's muzzle and takes it through the shifting in a car, you know?
Right.
Remember that?
The
collie's muzzle.
And the collie loves it.
And the collie loves it. And she looks at the old dog, and she calls it the face of love. And it's so simple, and it's just absolutely true. It's just an amazing piece of work. Yeah, thanks.
There's a question.
Oh.
I don't really know.
Elizabeth von Arnim,
yes.
All the Dogs of My Life.
I've never read that book.
Oh, Sigrid's going to read it. I love that book, and I was both thrilled to find it and read it and sort of dismayed because, not really dismayed, I'm not going to write a memoir, but I had thought that if I ever did, the way it would be organized was by dog. You know, the years that I had which dog, which of course is what Elizabeth von Arnim does. And it's so logical and brilliant.
Now, I don't know if she is the person who said this. I don't think it is. But somebody once defined life, said life, 7 dogs and then you die.
I haven't heard that.
And she has, in that memoir, she has a beautiful line, I'll have to dumbly paraphrase in the beginning, something like, you know, looking back, I can't believe there were whole years of my life that I was not making some good dog happy.
Oh.
And you just like her after that.
Yeah. I haven't read that either. See, all these wonderful dog books.
It's actually, I talked with Ray, and it was one of the books. It's actually, he had a very, really difficult childhood. His parents were alcoholics, and he had a really hard time. And he's not at all sentimental, but he really makes you love the dogs and feel very grateful for what the dogs mean to him, Gary Paulson, and what he gave the dogs. I think there's like a few stories.
I would recommend Conversations with Dean Spanley and then the movie Dean Spanley.
I haven't read that either.
I don't know about this.
He remembers his life as a dog. It's very, very rich and wonderful. After he drinks Tokai, a Hungarian liqueur, he remembers. I don't want to spoil it for you.
Okay.
Thank you for being here.
I have a question for Amy. I'm really interested in hearing a little more about the short shorts and how you teach a short short to students. I've been to, I'm a graduate of a grad program too.
Oh.
And so I've done like fiction workshops, uh-huh. but never with a short short. So I'm wondering,
okay, well, thank you, and thank you for coming tonight. I mean, I have a couple of times I've taught a class that I titled Short Short, Prose Poem, or Couldn't Finish. You know, because a lot of the students will hand in 2 pages and say, yeah, it's a short short. And I'm like, no, you just didn't know what to do next. You know, all right, you know. And then they'll admit it. Prompts, you know, there are whole books of prompts. There are only 2 that I ever use because they yield a lot, especially in the short form. One is to do a very short piece about a time you were blindsided. Mm. Point being, why didn't you see that coming? What is it you are looking at instead? From something like 9/11, you know, the attack, to 2008, the economy, you know, bottom dropping out, to something, someone dumping you. You know, I mean, just there's so many ways to be blindsided, you know. And then also I often have people write something about forgiveness, a time that, you know, maybe they asked somebody to forgive them and that person did or did not, or a time that, you know, you reverse it. But anyway, back to the shorts. I always, in teaching it, the form, I always have people read a lot of prose poems, too. There's not tons of difference some of the time. And Charles Simic, when he won the Pulitzer some years ago for The World Doesn't End, which was, of course, wonderful book, right? A collection of prose poems. you know, suddenly prose poems were bankable, like, you know, in a real way again. There's still a lot of that attitude out there, you know, a prose poem is neither, you know, that, and even poets don't always like them, but I feel like I'm stumbling around and not really answering your interesting question, but breaking it down more. I'm thinking, I love reading books written in fragments, you know, or going even, you know, breaking it down even more. A couple of Maggie Nelson's books, one of Evie Thomas's memoirs, Safekeeping, her first memoir, is written in.
James Tate has written wonderful.
There's so much out there. If you want some more suggestions, I'll speak with you after. Thank you.
How are we doing on time, Alice?
Okay.
Yes.
It had a title, something like Your Dog Really Does Love You, which I found to be very exciting because you read so much about, you know, well, they really, all they want is food. So there was an article yesterday.
There was, and there was also one not that long ago called Your Cat Really Loves. It was about how your cat really loves you. It's not... And I'm just thinking, I know that we want in the news, we're dying for some lightness and whatever, but this is the New York Times is publishing articles called Your Dog Really Loves You, like you, that never, no, no shit. It was very odd. I mean, it was a pitch for the Safina book, and he does write brilliantly about all, you know, and it was, and I, you know, and of course I read every line of it. Right? Of course I read it. I was happy to read it, but it did seem to, presenting it that way, just seemed rather ridiculous, as if the world needed the New York Times, the failing New York Times, to tell us that, you know, your dog. Did you know that, Amy? Did your dog really loves you?
I had an inkling that he was madly in love with
madly
me.
Madly in love, yeah, and cats too. Pretty. They love us.
Yes.
The question really is, why do they love us? Why? I mean, we're so lucky.
Yeah.
Really, we really are. Well, because we bred them too. But
yeah.
but you, yes, know that we really are lucky that they love us. Like
we
that.
Are.
We really are.
Thank you so much for coming and your
Thank
questions.
You. Thank you.